Welcome back to another edition of Behind the Headlines. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Once again, I'll be guiding you through some of the biggest headlines this week. In today's show, if you're a parent of a child with a learning disability, would you spend $5,000 on an untested treatment? Some parents are choosing to. We'll have more on that from business reporter Agnel Philip. And Governor Walker took to the stage Thursday night in Fox News' highly watched presidential debate. How did he fare compared to other candidates? And what's next for the governor? Reporter Craig Gilbert joins us from Washington with more. And while we're speaking of Governor Walker, there's one thing he keeps mentioning on the campaign trail: his victory in the recall election. It's really the thing that makes him stand apart from the other candidates in the crowded Republican field. So how do recall supporters feel about it now? Political reporter Jason Stein found out.
Governor Walker is making this run for the presidency. And one of the big narratives that he's running on is his victory in the recall election. So could you kind of walk me through your story about that?
What I did was I went back and I talked to the labor leaders, Democrats, grassroots organizers that were the architects of that recall effort. And I said, hey, what you guys did in 2012 is the first thing that the governor talks about when he's on the campaign trail in Iowa and New Hampshire and such. And how do you guys feel about that? Do you have any regrets at trying to take him on, failing, and then, you know, allowing him to grow much more influential in the Republican Party?
Did they have any regrets, and what were they?
Not really. No. One of them, the person who started the United Wisconsin website that gathered the signatures or was the big tool used by organizers in gathering the signatures, he told me about 15 minutes ago that he really thought that they were, in his words, going to be able to take down Scott Walker, even though obviously that's not what Democrats nationally, that's not the way they read it, even by, you know, the fall of 2011, early 2012. So no, I mean, the only regret that I heard from any of them was that they wished they had had the ability under Wisconsin election laws to have better situated the recall around the 2012 presidential election.
That's interesting to me. I would think that they would have some regrets there just because now he's on the national stage. Now this message might be taken across the nation.
Absolutely. I mean, I think what you had in Scott Walker certainly had notoriety in 2011 for his Act 10 law, which repealed most collective bargaining for most public employees. He had that notoriety, but after the recall, he also had a national network. So he, whether it was small-time donors or the billionaires who are currently being tapped to fund his national super PAC and his presidential ambitions, he absolutely got out of the recall effort something that distinguishes him from, say, John Kasich.
So say you are Hillary Clinton or you're Bernie Sanders, you're also making the same bid for the presidency. How are they using this narrative or addressing this narrative?
You know, I think they probably end up doing what Barack Obama did. You know, Barack Obama, very famously, his advisors attempted to discourage the recall in 2011 and 2012. And when they failed in that effort, rather than taking, some sort of active steps to stop it, they just sat back and did not associate themselves with it. So you had, Barack Obama famously not campaigning against Scott Walker or on behalf of his opponent, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett. He stayed away from the recall. And, what do you know? 5 months later, he ended up winning Wisconsin, the same state where in November 2012, the same state where Scott Walker won in June 2012, 5 months earlier.
So how is this narrative playing over with voters in Iowa and New Hampshire?
Well, they definitely like the fact that Scott Walker took on unions in his state and won, And obviously, you know, there are other candidates that did similar things. John Kasich of Ohio signed a similar law, but it was repealed by voters. You know, Chris Christie of New Jersey famously talked, you know, and criticized unions in his state. But one thing that primary voters like, Republican primary voters like about Scott Walker is that he took on unions and won and has the battle scars to prove it. So, I mean, certainly you're going to hear Scott Walker, as long as he's in the race for president, talking in every appearance about that 2012 recall.
Of course, this isn't the only thing Governor Walker mentions on the campaign trail. Jason said he also brings up the fact that he's won two other elections, that he's passed a number of conservative measures, and, as Jason said, Walker has done more to change the political and legal complexion than any other figure in our state's history. But the recall election is the one thing that most people know about Scott Walker, even if they don't know anything else. If you're interested in more on this story, pick up Sunday's edition of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can also find that story online. It's at jsonline.com/politics. For those with a fine memory of pop culture, the name Iceberg Slim may ring a bell. Iceberg was a pimp in major metropolitan cities, and his roots stretch back to Milwaukee. After a stint in prison, he took to writing. His style, which didn't hold back from telling the ugly truth of things, resonated with the likes of more recent figures like Ice-T. Author Jason Gifford has a new book about Iceberg Slim, and I sat down with books editor Jim Higgins to talk about it.
I read a biography called Street Poison, the biography of Iceberg Slim. It's by Justin Gifford, who's a professor of English at the University of Nevada, Reno. What's interesting about Iceberg Slim is that's the pen name for a man who wrote an autobiography called Pimp, literally about being a brutal and successful pimp on the streets of America's big cities. Milwaukee can take some credit for him turning out that way. When this gentleman died, he was known as Robert Beck. He used different names at other points. But when he was a boy, he was living in Rockford with his mother and her second husband, his stepfather. His mother was charmed by a hustler and took off to Milwaukee with young Robert and the hustler, who soon abandoned them when they reached Milwaukee. So they were here, he was a teen, making a new life for themselves, and he became entranced with life on the street and really took to, and this is the 30s, really took to the pimps he saw as people of wealth and power and tried to emulate them. He spent some time in the Wisconsin State Reformatory, which is now known as the Green Bay Correctional Institute, and at Waupun. And during his time in prison, he actively apprenticed himself to older pimps and hustlers. He wanted to learn their art, their trade. After he got out, he practiced the trade of pimping in Chicago and other big cities. He psychologically brutalized women to work for him. Later on, you know, edging into the 60s, after another spell of prison at Fort Leavenworth, he realized he was getting too old for this. And in the casting around of what to do, he ended up writing an autobiography called Pimp, which became one of the biggest pieces of street literature of its time. It was a million seller through the network which African-Americans bought pulp fiction and pulp books. So you couldn't have walked into a traditional bookstore in Milwaukee and bought it, but you could buy it at a hair salon or at a black-owned business that featured, you know, pulp fiction and other popular reading for African Americans. And one of the things that makes Iceberg Slim so important is so many other people point to his writing now. The gangster rappers Ice Cube and Ice-T both took the ice part of the names from him in homage to him. And people like Dave Chappelle and Chris Rock point to his works as speaking a kind of truth or telling it like it is on the streets.
So if you've read his book, if you've read Pimp, what would reading this book give you in addition to that?
Professor Gifford goes a long way to try to sort out what's true, what's not true. He really delves into what formed Iceberg Slim, you know, how he came from where he was. And the man wrote a number of other books, and he gives kind of a critical walkthrough of those too.
Now, when you told me a little bit about this book before, what came to mind is whether or not the book makes some sort of moral absolution of Slim or comes to some sort of moral conclusion about him. Do you think that the book does that?
I think the author is very careful. One, it's definitely not approval. He makes it really clear that Slim was really brutal to women. I mean, the whole art of pimping in his time was, you know, finding vulnerable women, keeping them off balance, you know, psychologically tormented and dependent on the pimp. So it's very clear, you know, that this was bad stuff. I think what the author finds fascinating about pimp and Slim's fiction is the very straight talk, no moralizing way the author tells those stories. Like Slim doesn't apologize for being a bad person or a bad character. He just tells it. There's a certain power in telling a bad story the way it went down. I would not say that Gifford approves of his behavior. He's just very careful to spell out what it is. He said in our interview that Slim's a mess of contradictions that basically are unresolvable. When his mother ripped him apart from the stepfather and came to Milwaukee, you know, that certainly was traumatic, but Slim used that throughout his life to justify his behavior of women. And as the author said, yes, there was trauma, but also was a very convenient story he told himself to rationalize his behavior.
In his review, Jim said that Gifford's book is both thoroughly researched and smoothly written. That's certainly no easy feat. For more on the book, pick up Sunday's edition of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel or visit tapmilwaukee.com. And never fear, sports fans. Later in the show, we've got Gary D'Amato talking about the PGA Championship at Whistling Straits in Wisconsin. Stay tuned for that. In business news, I kind of walked through this scenario before, but say you're a parent of a child with a learning disability. If traditional tested therapies don't seem to be working, would you try something out of the ordinary? And at what cost would you try it? Business reporter Agnel Philip wrote about one business that claims it can help parents in this exact scenario.
The Brain Balance Center in Mequon is part of a national franchise that has nearly 80 locations across the country. And essentially what they claim they can do is use different physical activities and cognitive activities to activate underperforming parts of the brain. And they have a specific theory that in children with learning disabilities, one side of the brain dominates the other, kind of like a right-left thing. They contend that their activities can help stimulate whatever the weaker part is and make it develop in line with the other side.
Now, this doesn't come without a cost, though.
Yeah, so the costs are a little complicated. When I talk to the company's CEO, nationally, it can vary between $5,000 and $7,000 for a three-month session, and these three-month sessions are 3 days a week, 1 hour each day. And that's the price range. In Mequon, I believe it's $5,000. Some kids, including two of the families that I interviewed for the piece, their kids went through six-month programs, so they spent $10,000 on the total thing. So, yes, it comes at a pretty substantial cost, especially considering that nobody else can pick up the tab for it. It isn't covered under any insurance plans, and it also the school districts can't pay for it, anything like that. So it's completely out of the families that I talked to were very convinced that the program helped their kids, and obviously if there's a program that'll help your kid improve, there's definitely parents out there that would say there's no price tag you could put on that. The other side of it is that this program, and this is what the story focuses on in great detail, doesn't have rigorous scientific studies to kind of back up its claims. So it doesn't have studies that prove that it works. It doesn't have studies that prove it doesn't work, but the biggest thing is there are other evidence-based treatment methods out there for learning disabilities that have rigorous studies behind them and can be covered under insurance or through school districts. And there's high out-of-pocket costs, but the other side of it is that you know it works and you know that it's been proven to work. That's not the case with this program.
So for the medical professionals you talked to about this story, what were some of their criticisms of Brain Balance?
First and foremost, it was that there was a lack of evidence and that a lot of the marketing was based off of testimonials. Beyond that, they also said that the ideas that this program had, and that the creator, who I also talked to as well, his name is Robert Melillo, the kind of theory he developed of how the brain of these children works doesn't really match up to the current scientific understanding or mainstream scientific understanding of how that program works. So the left-right thing is not actually, you know, what a lot of other scientists have seen in replicated research. It's more of a whole brain connection issue over long and short distances, but you know, the idea that certain skills are on one hemisphere or the other isn't really backed up by anything other than kind of the fringe parts of science and these guys in particular. So that was the two-pronged concern that they had. And ultimately, their concern came down to you only have so many resources in terms of time and money to spend on treatments. So you are much better off paying for things that have been proven to work.
So at the end of a story like this, where you have one side that says this isn't proven to work, maybe people see results because there are other treatments going on, it's uncertain. And then, you know, on the flip side of that coin, you have people who are very supportive of the program and who would recommend it to people in a similar situation. How do you balance that as a reporter when you're writing the story?
I think it really comes down to, first of all, you have to filter out the arguments that are most plausible and the arguments that aren't really backed up by anything other than this specific person's statement, which was tough because a lot of the research that has been done on this program has been, you know, done by the same four or five people. So it's a tough balancing act, and that's something that me and the editors had to balance. But ultimately, you know, you lay it all out there. And you just see, you have to let people decide. And I think the main goal I had with the piece was to kind of make it more than just a piece on brain balance. I wanted it to be like, if you have a kid who has a learning disability of any sort, what kinds of questions should you be asking before you go through it?
At the risk of editorializing, I give Agnel a lot of credit for writing a story like this. It doesn't make any final judgments about what's right. It really lets the reader determine whether or not going for an unusual or untested therapy is correct. If you're interested in reading the story, you can find it in Sunday's edition of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel or online at jsonline.com/business. Fox News drew major ratings with its debate on Thursday night. 23.9 million viewers, to be exact. It was the highest-rated presidential primary debate ever. One of the 10 candidates to make the cut was Wisconsin's Governor Scott Walker. How did Walker fare in the debate? Reporter Craig Gilbert joined editor Greg Borowski from Washington, D.C. on Friday during a special edition of our JS on Politics show with an answer to that question.
We're joined now by Craig Gilbert, our Washington bureau chief, who was covering the debate last night in Cleveland. So first, good morning, Craig.
Good morning.
All right. Last night, the format, we talked in our preview show about how it's just a different dynamic with 10 candidates on the stage. They sort of had these, you know, inconsistent questions to each and really pointed in many ways. What was your take on the format and how it affected the outcome?
Well, I mean, with 10 candidates on the stage, there were sort of one of two ways this could have gone. One was for it to make for a very stilted debate where there was no flow, and the other was what we got last night, which was more like a kind of a free-for-all and a carnival and a very entertaining and colorful debate. It did, you know, when you have 10 candidates, it really mattered who got what questions, and the panelists played a huge role in this. You know, introduces some kind of inequities in the debate because the candidates have no control over which questions they get. But, you know, they have to step up to the plate. And I think in some cases, some candidates kind of receded into the background, either because they wouldn't get questions for long periods of time. In the case of Governor Walker, I think in some cases his answers were so abbreviated that he didn't have as much airtime, particularly early in the debate, as he might have liked. And he had to field some tough questions, which I think he did reasonably well, but they were questions that they weren't always subjects that he wanted to talk about.
Yeah, well, what's one thing that struck me is when you're in a more conventional format, you half the time at least you know the question that's coming because it's been asked of your opponent, and here it was a little more think on your feet. I mean, how for Walker overall, how would you grade his performance?
I think he did okay. I think it was sort of as advertised. I think he played it pretty safe. I think, you know, he signaled pretty clearly that he wasn't going to get into the trenches with the other Republican candidates, and he didn't. It was important to him to kind of keep to that kind of genial demeanor that we see from him on the campaign trail. He's trying to project a certain tone. The downside of that was that he didn't have a high-profile debate. He had some good moments, but he was not a huge presence on that debate stage. He didn't necessarily need to be because he's in better shape in this race than a lot of other people who were on that stage who really needed to force themselves into the action. A few of them did that. So I would say he, at a minimum, he did himself no harm. It was a debate that was kind of consistent with the way he's run his campaign. Maybe a little bit of a lost opportunity in the sense that he probably could have gotten a little bit more out of the debate than he did.
What was the assessment of his campaign team afterwards? And were they pleased with how it went, or
They called the spin room for a reason, and they they told us and they told me that they thought it was a good debate, that they thought he did what he needed to do. What they were saying after the debate was consistent with what they were saying before the debate, which is the kind of debate he wanted to have, his strategy going in. He wasn't going to worry about what everybody else on the stage was doing. He was going to try to project a message. I think it did take him a while to kind of get to the core of his message. The whole message about fighting and winning all these battles in Wisconsin, which is sort of the uniqueness of his appeal to Republican primary voters, we didn't really hear that until his closing remarks, which is the one part of the debate where you do have some control, absolute control, over what you're going to say.
All right. Now, looking forward, the governor, of course, is an experienced politician. He'll adapt and adjust to these formats as he gets more comfortable with them. But what do you think he will be looking to do or needs to adapt to, for the next go-round in about a month?
Well, I think the big thing is just to get the most out of his answers. I looked up at the 30-minute mark, and he'd had basically 40 seconds of talking time. And he ended up with less time than all but one of the other Republicans on stage. It's not a huge deal, but again, I think you want to get the most out of these opportunities. And he was so kind of economical in some of his answers that he left time on the table. And I think even saw him get better as the debate went on and getting the most out of his time.
All right. And lastly, best moment and worst moment in your mind for the governor last night?
I don't know if there's a worst moment. I do think, again, the criticism is that in some cases his answers were abbreviated and they didn't register. I think his best moment was the one-liner about, the Russian and Chinese hacking and how at this point the Russian and Chinese governments probably know more about Hillary Clinton's email server than members of Congress do. That got a big laugh out of the audience. It was obviously a prepared line, but I think it was kind of a high moment for him among Republican primary voters.
There's plenty more coverage of this week's debate available online at jsonline.com/politics. You'll find a replay of our JS on Politics shows there. You can also subscribe to those at iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Also on our politics page online, we've got a roundup of national claims made during the debate, among other things. Fact check there. Go ahead and check it out. And if you want to keep an eye on Walker's progress on the campaign trail, you can follow along at jsonline.com/Scott Walker. It's the latest and arguably the greatest final event in the golf season. Here's Matt Velasquez and Gary D'Amato with more.
The PGA Championship is coming to Whistling Straits this week, and golf reporter Gary D'Amato will be providing thorough coverage throughout. Gary, who are some players to watch in this, the final major event of the season?
Well, there's really some great young players that everyone's going to be watching, and I think we have to start with Jordan Spieth. Young man won two majors to start the year, the Masters and the U.S. Open. Then he went to the British Open with a chance for the Grand Slam to win all four in 1 year, and actually got in the lead with a couple holes to play, bogeyed the 71st hole at the old course at St. Andrews and missed the playoff by one shot. I read in an interview that he is going to seek revenge and try to seek revenge on and win this last major championship, so he's one guy definitely we'll be watching. Another guy is Rory McIlroy, 26 years old from Northern Ireland. Rory is a defending champion, but he's been out since early July after rupturing a ligament in his ankle playing in a soccer kickball with friends. And There have been reports that Rory's going to try to play some practice rounds before the championship starts, test the ankle, and see if he's ready to go. So if he's in the field, it's going to be really interesting because, A, can he even walk that course with a bad ankle? Will he wear down through the week and have to withdraw? Or will he be on top of this game and challenge Jordan Spieth? I wouldn't expect the latter, but you never can tell. Another guy to watch, obviously, is Tiger Woods, who has struggled greatly for a couple of years now. Seems to be finding something maybe in his last couple starts. His last start, he played pretty well on Thursday and Friday and then had a bad Saturday round. But whenever Tiger shows up for a tournament, there's always interest. So it'll be interesting to see if he makes the cut, if he contends, if he somehow gets himself onto the leaderboard on Sunday. It would be a tremendous story. He hasn't been on leaderboards for a long time. So that's another guy we'll definitely be watching. And then, last but not least, Dustin Johnson. In 2010, Dustin had a chance to get into a playoff and grounded his club in a bunker on the 72nd hole. Inadvertently, he didn't know it was a bunker, but he incurred a two-stroke penalty, made a double bogey, missed the playoff. And since then, he's also had a number of close calls in majors, maybe some championships he should have won and didn't. And so he'll come with a lot of baggage to Whistling Straits and see if he can shrug that off. A tremendous talent, maybe definitely one of the most talented players in the world, but he's got all this baggage from these close calls and majors. So those would be some of the guys I'd be looking at.
You know, and as you mentioned with Dustin Johnson in the bunker in 2010, you know, Whistling Straits has been the home for multiple dramatic finishes, you know, both in major events, both in 2010 and in 2004. You know, what is it about the course that lends itself to such closely packed leaderboards and tight finishes?
Yeah, I think it's a course. For one thing, the course doesn't seem to favor one particular player. Sometimes you get a course that really favors the long hitters and kind of eliminates the guys who don't hit it a long way. Sometimes you get a course that favors great putters. Well, every course you have to putt great at. But the thing with Whistling Straits is it doesn't favor a particular player. For instance, 2010, Zach Johnson missed the playoff by one shot. Very short hitter compared to some of the big guys. Rory McIlroy was there at the finish, and then we had the Bubba Watson, one of the longest hitters in golf, was in a playoff that was won by Martin Keimer. So it doesn't favor a particular player. But then the other thing I think is the last four holes at Whistling Straits are brutally, brutally difficult holes, and the field tends to bunch up on those holes. There's a par 5, number 16, you can make a birdie on and get close to the leaders, or if you have a one-shot lead, you can maybe stretch it to two. But then you come to 17 and 18, two extremely difficult holes. Anything can happen on those holes. Pars, bogeys, double bogeys. We saw a penalty with Dustin Johnson. So I think when you combine those factors, that's what makes Whistling Straits prone to having these dramatic finishes.
And that'll do it for this week's show. Thanks again for listening. If you don't want to miss next week's episode, be sure to subscribe to this podcast at iTunes or Stitcher Radio.